Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at Graymeer Church of Christ.
Whoever, therefore, breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of the judgment. And whoever says to his brother, Raca, shall be in danger of the council. But whoever says, you fool, shall be in danger of the hellfire. Therefore, if you bring your gift to the altar, and there remember that your brother has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go your way. First, be reconciled with your brother, and then come and offer your gift. Agree with your adversary quickly, while you are on the way with him, lest your adversary deliver you to the judge, and the judge hand you over to the officer, and you be thrown into prison. Assuredly, I say to you, you will by no means get out of there until you have paid the last penny.
I don't know what kind of week you had last week. There may have been something special that took place. It might have been an ordinary week. You might have faced something challenging. But I can tell you that, personally, there was a big day for me last week. It was a big day because stopping in a gas station on the way to Columbia from a preacher's meeting, I found a Coke bottle with my name on it. I had been looking for one of these Coke bottles that would have the name Andrew. I found every other name you could think of, and finally there it was, just staring at me as I walked in, a bottle with my name on it. Now, you've probably seen, like I have, this advertising campaign that evidently started in Australia in 2011 and worked its way through Europe and now has made its way to the States. And you have these Coke cans and bottles that have names on them. And it's a genius marketing strategy because when you look at it, you're going to want to buy something that has your name on it. It appeals to our ego. And you're going to want to take a picture of it. And you're going to want to tell people about it. Maybe post something on Facebook or Twitter or other social media sites. And I knew all of this in my mind. I know all of it now. And yet I still bought a Coke with my name on it. It didn't stop me from buying it and taking a picture of it. I mean, there's just something about that. It's amazing to see what it's like when there's just one little change on the surface of something and it changes our whole perspective. You may have seen some people that got really creative with some of these Coke bottles and Coke cans. If you are a fan of Batman, you'll like this next one. Bruce Wayne took a picture of both of those together. If you're a romantic, you'll like the idea of someone proposing by specially ordering some of these bottles with different names on them. And you may fall into the category of this next picture where you still can't find your name, no matter how many of these things you look for. It's interesting to see how just the slightest little change on the surface could change our whole perspective. We've been working through the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. And we've been thinking about what Jesus is saying in this incredible landmark sermon to his disciples. And I'm reminded of how we seem to respond favorably to changes on the surface. Just think of what it's like when you look at a room and it's one color and you decide to paint it another color. It could change the whole way you think about that area. Something about the surface change. that can be powerful. Or maybe you have a car that looks one way, but then when you put a fresh coat of wax on it, it looks another way. It's an incredibly powerful change. It appeals to us. It appeals to our eyes. It looks different. There are times when the surface level change can be really appealing. But there's also something important to remember. If I buy a Coke bottle that has my name on it, that hasn't changed any of the contents of the actual bottle, has it? There's really nothing different from me buying that bottle than a bottle over here that doesn't have my name. There's nothing different about the nutritional value. It doesn't get healthier, sadly enough, if it's got our name on it. It still has the same nutritional value. It's still got the same formula. It's going to taste the same. And if I've got a house that I've put a fresh coat of paint on, that's a wonderful surface level change. But if there are other issues that have to be dealt with, a coat of paint doesn't fix that. Or if my car's having engine problems, I can clean it up and put a coat of wax on it, but that doesn't solve the engine problems. You see, surface level changes can only go so far. And what we see from the passage that we just read is that true righteousness, the kind of righteousness Jesus talks about in the Sermon on the Mount, comes from the inside out. That it's not just about a surface level change that might change the way other people see us, but it's about how we're living from the inside out. And as Jesus comes to this point in the sermon, you may remember that he started with the Beatitudes, announcing these blessings on people who it seemed like weren't very blessed. People who were poor in spirit, and people who were mourning, and who were persecuted. And then Jesus moves from the Beatitudes to describe his followers as salt and light, and that their works glorify God. So it's not that he's blessed people and says, now you just sort of keep yourself away from the world. He says, you're blessed, but you're called to be salt and light in the world. And he gets to a point in Matthew chapter 5, which I think is a key for us to understand the entire Sermon on the Mount. Because he starts talking about his mission. And he starts talking about the kinds of righteousness that he calls us to. And if you look at verse 17, he begins by describing his relationship with the law. Now, Jesus' ministry would create a lot of waves between the religious leaders of the time. The Pharisees, who were very concerned about their own sense of control or power in the religious realm. The Sadducees, who were more politically connected, they were a smaller group than the Pharisees, but they were equally concerned because they were sort of the political favorites, and they kind of had a little more connection, and so they were worried about what Jesus was teaching. And Jesus heads all that off at the very beginning by saying, "Do not think that I came to abolish the law or the prophets." He says, "I did not come to abolish, but to fulfill." Jesus did not come to set aside or to go against the law. And it's helpful for me to know that, especially as I think about this kind of righteousness that's found in Jesus, that he's not opposed to what's happened before. Yes, when we read through Scripture, we find the New Covenant, there are different guidelines for us to live under than the Old Covenant. And we need to understand that. But we also need to know that Jesus didn't come out of opposition to what we read about in the Old Testament. I think that's important. It's important for us to see that the Old Testament is valuable. These books of Scripture in the Old Testament are not only important for us to have some interesting reading, but they impact our lives and our understanding of God. And the God of the Old Testament is the same as the God in the New Testament, and he sent Jesus. And the term he uses here for abolish would have referred to setting aside the entire system of Jewish law and everything that was involved in it. Jesus wasn't opposed to the law. In fact, Jesus was the fulfillment of the law. And so, yes, when we come to a new covenant, we live differently, but it's not because the old law has been set aside as much as it's been fulfilled. It's not that the old law has been destroyed as much as Jesus has fulfilled it. Because of his fulfillment, now we have a new covenant. We still need to look back to what we can gain from the Old Testament. Paul would tell the church at Galatia that it was like a schoolmaster or a tutor that leads us to Christ. And so we don't want to forget those lessons that lead us to Jesus. And he's reminding them that he didn't come to abolish those things. And when he makes the statement that not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass from the law until all is accomplished, he was making a big claim. And he was using a phrase that would have been familiar to the Jews at that time. Jewish writings have been discovered that shed light on some of this discussion about the smallest letter being removed from God's law. And so Jesus is taking a phrase that they would have been familiar with and saying, I'm not here to destroy the old law. I'm not here to abolish those things. He fulfills the old covenant and then establishes the new covenant. So it's important for us to understand this righteousness that Jesus is going to proclaim does not mean that he's got a better idea than God had originally. It's that he is the fulfillment of that idea in the Old Testament. And so we see that true righteousness is found in Jesus, and it begins from the inside out. If I had to choose a verse in the Sermon on the Mount that to me would be a sort of the theme verse, maybe the thesis statement for the sermon, it would probably be verse 20, where Jesus says, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. I think it's hard for us to imagine the impact that would have had on a first century audience. We look through the lens of hindsight, and we can see the flaws in some of the things the Pharisees were doing and saying. But we need to understand it wasn't a totally negative picture if you had grown up in that time. People likely would have seen Pharisees as individuals you wanted to emulate. They were the source of authority if you had a question about the law. And so for Jesus to say your righteousness has to exceed their righteousness, it probably would have hit them pretty hard. It might be like saying your investment strategy has to exceed Warren Buffett's investment strategy, or your slam dunks have to exceed LeBron James' dunks in order to gain something. This would have been a real impact. They might have thought, well, how does this happen? And for the rest of the sermon, Jesus describes true righteousness. He goes on for the rest of this chapter, and he lists six different, sort of, we might call them case studies, of how someone would look at this as righteousness, but there's a deeper root. In chapter 6, he goes through and talks about giving and praying and fasting, three elements that they would have been very familiar with as they practiced the Mosaic law and as they practiced that kind of devotion. And he would say, here's how the hypocrites do it, and you want to do it differently. It's about something being done in secret. It's about the change in you rather than being noticed by men. And each of those times he describes that people who seek to be known by men have their reward in full. He ends the sermon in Matthew chapter 7 by saying, here's how you know whether or not you've done the will of my Father who is in heaven. So this kind of righteousness is a thread that runs through the whole sermon. And it starts from the inside out. And it's hard for us to remember because we think about what we look at on the look like on the outside. We think about our reflection in the mirror. We think about what other people see when they look at us. I wonder if we were to compare how much time we spend looking in a mirror and trying to think about our outer image to how much time we spent caring for our inner character and inner righteousness, we might be surprised with how much time we think about what's on the outside. And yet true change, true righteousness, doesn't begin there. And it requires effort. It's interesting to me to see how Jesus connects righteousness also with works that glorify God. In verse 16, he says, people will see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. And then he's going to give examples. Every time he uses one of these case studies in the rest of Matthew 5, he gives an example where he says, don't do this, but here's how you live this way. Here's how you accomplish this. Jesus doesn't grant us a righteousness and now we no longer have any obligation. It's not something that frees us from ever having to live the way God wants us to, and now we've got this righteousness and it's ours and I can hold on to it and I'll never have to do anything. Jesus makes it very clear that while righteousness is found in Him, it requires our effort. It requires work. It requires us to think differently, to live differently. It starts on the inside. And we read the first of these case studies that Jesus uses to illustrate this true righteousness. The first Jesus points to is a well-known command against murdering. You might remember that this would have been the sixth commandment of the Ten Commandments. You shall not murder would have been something they would have been very familiar with. And Jesus says, you've heard that it was said, you shall not murder. And anyone who commits murder shall be liable to the court. And then notice the pattern he uses here that he'll use throughout the rest of the chapter. He says, you've heard it said, and then he'll say, but I say to you. Now what he does as he establishes this pattern is he shows us something we find out at the end of the sermon, and that is he's teaching with authority. That's the reason they're amazed at his sermon, because he's not teaching as a scribe or teacher of the law. He's teaching as someone who has the authority to be able to say, this means this, and here's what you should do. And this is what he does at the very beginning. He says, you've heard this was said, but I say to you. And when Jesus follows that I say to you, he's taking the commandment deeper. You probably can understand what it's like to try to pull some weeds in a garden. And you understand that you want to get as much of that up as possible. If you really want to get a plant, you want to get it by the roots. It's not just about what you can see. It's about what's under there, what's causing that growth. And so Jesus points to these commands and he says, we want to go to the root. What is the root of this action? And what he says when it comes to murder is the root of that action is anger. Now, I don't know exactly why Jesus would have started off with this one, but I know for us here, when we think of the command, you shall not murder, we might think to ourselves, you know, I'm doing pretty good on that. I haven't done that. That probably won't happen today. I'm probably free and clear when it comes to that commandment. And Jesus takes that and says, well, maybe so, but have you thought about anger? Because Jesus says, I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty. It's not just those who've committed murder, but there's a serious penalty here for anger. And he's reminding us that those kinds of murderous actions stem from anger, and that comes from the inside. We don't have to look very far into Scripture to see an example of that. In Genesis chapter 4, when we see the very first recorded murder here between two brothers, Cain and Abel, look at the way verses 6 and 7 read. When this resentment is building up in Cain, here's what God says to him. He says, why are you angry? And why is your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. This picture, I think, is a fascinating one. Cain had become angry with his brother Abel. They both offered sacrifices, and God had regard for Abel's sacrifice. We don't know as many details as we'd like to know about the differences in them, but we do see that there was an issue here with Cain's attitude, and now he's angry. And notice what happens. He says, why are you angry and your face is fallen? What's the result of Cain's anger? That sin is crouching at the door. It's almost as if anger has set a trap now for Cain. And unless he did something about the anger, he wasn't going to be able to handle the sin that was crouching at the door. And we see what happens in the rest of that chapter. As Cain does take his brother's life, that anger allowed sin to come in. And so we are reminded of what Jesus says. He says, everyone who is angry shall be guilty before the court. And he also calls us to take our language with others and the things we say to others seriously. That term that he uses, raka, your translation may say good for nothing. It's an idea of being empty-headed. It would have been like calling someone a name that would call into question their intelligence, whether or not they really had a brain. Jesus calls us to think about the way we talk to people. And he says, if your anger is boiling over and you're calling others names, he says, you shall be guilty before the council. Your translations may say before, almost like the Supreme Court. And then when he talks about calling a brother you fool, that would have been more of an attack on his morality. And so what about the intelligence? But if you insult his morality, if your anger bubbles over into where you're spewing out these statements that I understand, but when translated, may sound very tame to us, but would not have been tame to Jesus' original audience. And he says, when you say this, he said, you'll be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell. What a description of the serious nature of anger. Now, it's important for us as we work through this to try to ask ourselves, how do we respond? When we have this situation that might be similar to Cain's, in that there's anger here and sin is crouching at the door, how do we respond? What do we do? I think Paul's words in Ephesians chapter 4 can give us some guidance. When he describes the process this way in verse 26, be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger and give no opportunity to the devil. To me, this passage reminds me a lot of what we see in Genesis chapter 4. When Cain was angry, sin was crouching at the door. Paul is saying, you know, if you're angry and if you allow that anger to fester, that idea of the sun going down on your anger, and you focus on it, that's giving the devil an opportunity or a foothold. That's giving him just a chance to sort of embed something sinful, a temptation in your life. And the more we dwell on that anger, the more tempting that becomes. And as Jesus does in each of these case studies, he gives an example of how we should react because of it. So he says, be angry, do not sin. Paul would say in Ephesians, Jesus would say, be careful about anger, because if you're angry with your brother, if you're spewing out these venomous names, then that causes guilt. Instead, seek to be reconciled to your brother. He gives us an example of what to do instead of being angry. Instead, seek out reconciliation. Even if you're presenting an offering at the altar, and you remember your brother has something against you, not that you have something against your brother, but your brother has something against you, make that right. Because that's a component in your worship to God. God cares about my relationship with others. He says, if you're going on the way, make friends with your opponent at law and make sure you can get this worked out before you get there. That's the kind of example he gives. The command was against murder. Jesus says the issue is anger. He gives six of these case studies in total. For the sake of time, we'll just look at the next two, and then next week we'll finish out this next three. Jesus points to another one of the Ten Commandments. As he talks about, you've heard it said, you shall not commit adultery. But then, just as he does with murder, he points to the root of that. And he says, but I say to you that anyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Lust is the issue. Here's the action, but Jesus is pointing to the issue. And again, in many ways, the Bible gives us some of the most vivid examples of what lust can do. In 1 Samuel 11, when we think about David in Bathsheba and the decision that David made that led to several other decisions that ended up with him committing murder and lying and coveting his neighbor's wife and committing adultery, all of those things started with lust that took place as David was on his roof and saw Bathsheba. Because of that, when the prophet Nathan comes to David and says, here's what's happened as a result, he lists these consequences that started there. Here's what's going to happen, that the child was going to die, that he was going to have the sword never depart from his household. And then as we continue reading in the story of David's life, he has children, and his son, Amnon, looks at his half-sister, Tamar. And because of lust that's there, he devises a way to get her alone. And he takes her and rapes her. And then now you've got this situation where Absalom is so angry with his half-brother Amnon that Absalom seeks out a way. And 2 years from there, Absalom kills Amnon. And then Absalom goes on the run. And then when he comes back, he's seeking to take his father's throne. And you see how so many things come from this root. And it reminds me of how important it is, Jesus is saying, to look at the root of the problem. And so he makes this statement. about if your right eye makes you stumble, to tear it out and cast it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. Jesus is using this hyperbolic statement to say, do what it takes to keep this from happening. He says it's better for you to make this one change than to lose your whole body. Or if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. You have this importance Jesus is placing, which reminds us how important it is to do what it takes in our life to cut lust out of the picture. Do what it takes to make sure that that I'm not looking at sites I shouldn't be looking at, that I'm not places I shouldn't be, that I'm not staying up at night flipping through channels that I shouldn't be watching. Whatever it takes in my life to get that opportunity away from me. Jesus calls us to look at the root. And then as a follow-up with that, he discusses another concept for us that's difficult to think about, and yet it's important in Jesus' sermon. He describes the Mosaic process of divorce. And as we see in other passages in Scripture, there was a way in which the law of Moses allowed for a certificate of divorce that in many cases, if not most cases, protected the woman so that she would be able to find another individual to marry and not be abused by her husband. And so there were laws that Moses had given them, and yet in Matthew 19 we find out that's because of the hardness of their hearts. And when Jesus is asked the question, he points back to creation. And he does that here by saying, you've heard this said. The law of Moses required this. Here's what I'm telling you. I'm telling you that this is such an important covenant, that this is so vital to God, that when we're married, he lists the only reason being the reason of unfaithfulness as a cause for divorce. But he's calling us to a radical commitment. In other words, he's saying when it comes to this vow, there needs to be a commitment to the other. And so again, he's pointing to the heart focusing on this command from God. In all three of these cases, he's pointing to something deeper. And as we are so many times in the sermon, we're challenged and we are called to look at our own lives and to say, what is it inside that I need to change so I can live a different way on the outside? It starts from the inside out. And next week, or a couple of weeks from now, as we go through these next three case studies that Jesus gives us, again, we'll be reminded of the importance of changing in our inner being. It's amazing to see how quickly fads can come up and how quickly something can become trendy and the thing to do, and this is going to solve all your problems. I think in the age of internet and social media, we see a lot more of that. And all of a sudden, there's something that comes up, and this is it. This is going to solve everything. And then 2 months later, no, I'm going to do this now, and this is what I'm going to start doing. And then 2 months later, no, I think now this is the kind of thing. This is going to give me peace. This is going to change my life. And it's all on the surface. And hopefully this morning, we've been reminded by Jesus that righteousness doesn't begin there. It begins with what we can't see. And the good news of the gospel is that we serve a God that cares enough about us. He's given us a way to be cleansed and to have righteousness. Even though you or I can't see it and you or I can't create it, God can give us forgiveness. And I know even as we talk about some of these passages in Matthew chapter 5 that focus on sins and focus on challenges, things that tempt all of us, things that we face, there might even be times we're cut to the heart and realize, you know, this sin has taken a hold of me and I need to change from the inside out. We also serve a God that once we have become Christians, we have the chance for forgiveness. If we're willing to walk in the light and follow Him, and at times when we stray away, if we're willing to come back to Him, we can be forgiven. Change can happen. It can happen from the inside out. And if you need a change in your life this morning, please come and let us know as we stand and worship together.